Before we start, Real Science Radio is sponsoring a tee box and closest to pin competition at a golf tournament on Friday, May 19th. The fundraiser is for Uganda orphans through the charity Restoration Gateway. Just go to restorationgateway.org/events to sign up and golf with RSR host Fred Williams and his son and frequent guest RSR host Ryan Williams. We'll post a link to that on the rsr.org homepage. And now let's jump right into the broadcast.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I'm Fred Williams, host of Real Science Radio.
And I'm Ryan Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Ryan, it's always great to have you back in the studio, which also means it's time to go through our favorite creation magazine, which happens to be called Creation Magazine.
It's great to be back and always an honor to go through this great magazine.
Well, I was thinking about this morning, Ryan. It's actually been going on 17 years when Bob and I first started going through this fantastic magazine put out by Creation Ministries International. And the latest issue I have here is volume 45, number 2. And Ryan, what's that thing on the cover?
It's a marmoset, like a monkey. So according to Encyclopedia Britannica, it's any of a numerous species of small, long-tailed South American monkeys. Similar in appearance to squirrels, marmosets are tree-dwelling primates that move in a quick, jerky manner.
So the thing's a jerk.
I'd say it's quick and jerky, not a jerk. Okay. But given it's a monkey, so you never know, because Some of those things are mean.
Yeah, they can be. So, in fact, we saw some down in Costa Rica when we were down there, I don't know, a couple months ago.
Yeah.
But Ryan, this little guy, we're going to get to him in a bit. There's a story behind the marmoset and the fact that it's found in both Africa and South America. And the question is how did it migrate there? And we'll see that the evolutionists are now appealing to a concept that creationists actually proposed a while back. But before we get to that, I did want to share an email from one of our listeners, and this came from a show from a few weeks ago, and it was pertaining to a news story that we mentioned from Science Daily that with Doug and I mentioned, and Doug, he's on special assignment right now. So namely, that article is, "Where Did Earth's Water Come From? Not Melted Meteorites, According to Scientists." So Ryan, were you aware that evolutionists thought that the water on our planet came from meteorites?
You know, I hadn't heard that before, but I'm not really surprised because they always seem to conjure up fantastical ideas and fantasy fairy tale stuff. So I'm not surprised, but I've never heard it before.
Okay. Yeah. I'd heard something like that before, but man, I didn't realize they thought all the water came from meteorites. So anyways, one of our listeners, he did some math on this, and he used very favorable assumptions for evolution, such as using the world's largest meteor source of water and at the rate of the heaviest meteor shower ever. And this is what he found after running the math, running all these favorable assumptions for the evolutionary point of view. And I want to quote him. I thought this was hilarious. He goes, "Therefore, using my vast superior rural community high school math education, from which I graduated in the top 300 of my class, it would require a bombardment of the world's largest carbonaceous chondrites falling at the heaviest rate ever recorded, 252,000 times the conjectured evolutionary age of the solar system, to bring the present weight of the ocean water to Earth. Please note, this does not include the evaporation rates, which are probably well made up for by annual rainfall with runoff from the continents. And by the way, I'm not the one that said the present is the key to the past."
Yeah, that's hilarious.
It was a great email. I want to thank that listener for sending that in. And we love getting your emails. And he had at the very end of his email, he had this clip from an old movie, Naked Gun, if anybody remembers those. And it's really good. It's the thing where I'll have our producer play that clip right now.
All right, move on. Nothing to see here. Please disperse. Nothing to see here. Please
Nothing to see here. I love that. So, Ryan, let's get back to the show. Today's show.
All right. Now,
where do you want to get started?
One that stood out to me, it's called New Role Links All Sharp Things in Nature and More. And it's basically talking about how there's kind of a mathematic equation that can relate all sharp things. So, for example, like teeth in animals and whatnot. There's a rule that they found that kind of relates them all together.
Yeah, that is super cool. So it's a new rule links all sharp things. So the article mentions this. A team of scientists at Australia's Monash University has, quote, discovered a new universal rule of biological growth that explains surprising similarities in the shapes of sharp structures across a vast array of living things. Wow. So what is this rule? What is this mathematical law, Ryan?
Yeah, so it's a rule that they refer to as the power law, which essentially just describes the relationship between the width and length of these structures. And it can be anything from an elephant's tusk, like the article says, or a horn, or jaguar's claws or fangs of a spider, all these different things that are among so many different kinds of animals. They all follow this same rule that they call the power law.
It's interesting because so these animals that have these sharp things like teeth and like the fangs of a spider, all of them follow the same mathematical law. Yet these animals are widely dispersed across the so-called evolutionary tree of life. They're on totally different branches. So how did this happen? I mean, there's no way that's just a coincidence, or they probably would have to appeal to convergent evolution, how things evolved the same way down different paths. You know, like, for example, how the human or the eyeball has evolved. It's so similar among a lot of creatures, but they're vastly different creatures. Like the octopus eye is very similar to the human eye, yet we're so far apart on the tree of evolutionary life that they have to assume that something that vastly complex evolved independently of the other, which is just, it's a fantasy, Ryan.
Yeah.
There's nothing to see here.
Yeah,
so
you have to expect that this extremely miraculous evolution happened not once, but multiple times over and over again across the world. The odds of that are so low.
Yeah. And, you know, in the article, Creation Magazine editor mentions that centuries later, Galileo wrote that the universe is, quote, written in mathematical language. So the discovery that structures and living creatures follow a mathematical power law is fascinating, but not surprising.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's surprising to the evolutionists because, you know, everything's surprising to them because they have the wrong worldview.
Everything's surprising to them because the science just happens to never support their theories.
Yeah, and we've had other shows on mathematical fascinations that we find in nature. For example, you can go to our show, Real Science Radio Goes to Math Class, and that's at rsr.org/math, and it just shows all kinds of real interesting things mathematically that we find throughout life in the universe.
The next one, I thought it was pretty funny because it's just so ridiculous. And it's this evolutionary vision of the future that they have. So there was this telecommunications company, then they developed what they call Mindy. And it was a 3D model to basically kind of show what the continued use of screens and phones would do to the human body. So they have this model that's hunchback and it has a claw hand that's, you know, like stuck in phone grip position because people don't do anything else with their hands than grip a phone, so it's stuck there. And then the arm is locked in a 90 degree angle because that's where your phone's at all times. And they say this is what people are going to look like in 200 years because of constant phone use. And, you know, they use it as like not evolution in the past, but evolution in the future, where this is what's going to happen to people. But they ignore the fact that there's nothing in the DNA for clawed hand. So even if somebody was to have a clawed hand from holding their phone too much, it's they're not going to give it to their kids. Their kids not going to be born.
They're not going to pass that on. I'm looking at the picture right now. And like they've got, for example, you already mentioned the 90 degree arm holding out, you know, with the clenched fist. But the look at the skull, Ryan. I mean, it looks like an alien.
I mean,
they got the elongated
weird skull
in the back of its head. You know, just picture kind of that alien creature in that movie Alien. And just not quite as dramatic in that movie, but I'm sure that they could come up with some other weird thing as well. If you need to use your teeth more, they'll have some alien teeth that shoot out of its mouth to eat. I mean, this is just fantasy land, and it's not even based on good science, because it relies on something called Lamarckism that has been discredited for a long time. And that's where you say you lift weights and you're going to pass that lifting weights to your kids, so your kids are going to be born with big muscles. Well, we know that's not true. It's interesting, some of the funny things these evolutionists come up with, but I can warn the audience, and whenever it up 3000, the year 3000, we're not going to have a hunchback. Hopefully we're all in heaven and there's a new heavens and new earth. Mm-hmm. I would predict that would be the case before the year 3000, but we don't know for sure. But anyways, yeah, there's nothing to worry about here. Nothing to see here. This is fantasy land.
Yeah. What was interesting to me about even this is all this stuff that they have. What's funny is this is a lot worse than people right now too. It's not even like a gain, like a addition plus, like this weird creature on this thing was better than people now. Like it evolved. That's devolving if I've ever seen it, looking at this little AI generated thing that they have here. Just looks horrible.
Yeah, that's a good point. So this is really an example of de-evolution. Looking at this again, I see that they've got a second eyelid for, I guess, because of the computer glare from the cell phone. So anyways, Ryan, the next one I wanted to get into, it's in the focus section, and this is Creation Magazine 2023, Volume 45, Number 2. And this one's titled "Plague Resisting Gene Comes with a Downside." So Ryan, what's going on with this one?
This one was pretty interesting. Basically talking about how during the Black Death, there were some researchers who extracted DNA from the skeletons of people who died just before or during or sometime after the epidemic.
And this is the bubonic plague.
Yep. It goes to say that it seems that if someone had certain mutations in both copies of the gene ERAP2, they were 40% more likely to survive. It goes on and continues, that gene codes for the machinery that presents fragments of invading microbes to the immune system. So basically this gene's purpose is it presents foreign things in the body to the immune system so the body can attack it. But when this gene had a mutation, and when it basically wasn't working correctly, it actually worked well against the bubonic plague, or so these researchers thought.
Yeah, so again, they think that there was this certain mutations that gave him a better survival rate. The article mentions before there are celebrations about a beneficial mutation, there's a catch. That mutated gene is also linked to autoimmune diseases such as Crohn's disease. Such diseases, the immune system fails to recognize what's okay and it attacks part of one's own body. And that has serious health consequences, and I know people have such issues. So, like certain mutations that make bacteria resistant to antibodies, Ryan, this appears to be another mutation that helps survival, but has not caused a new improved organism. So, this reminds me of malaria. So, there's this whole thing that's called sickle cell anemia. We've mentioned it before on the show. So if you get this certain gene that's a faulty gene, it's a mutation that causes sickle cell anemia, which is not a good disease to have. And if you have that disease, it just happens that you're less susceptible to malaria. So Ryan, which would you rather have, a disease or a truck or a plane to leave the infected area with malaria? I'd opt for the U-Haul and get out of there. Yeah. I don't want to have a disease. Ryan, remember, we were at the AFC championship, no, AFC playoff game, divisional playoff game between the Broncos and the Steelers. And that was that incredible game where Tim Tebow had all those stats that matched 316, John 316, like 316 passing yards and all these other things. We were at that game. In fact, it was probably the coolest ending we've ever seen to a Bronco game when he threw that touchdown in overtime. Well, do you remember who was missing in that game?
Yeah, there was a guy for the Steelers, his name was Ryan Clark, and he was their safety, and he could never play in Denver because he had sickle cell anemia. So the altitude, it was too risky for him to play. So he can never play here. And he's just one of a lot of the athletes who can't play in Denver because they have sickle cell and the altitude. It's too dangerous. It's literally too dangerous for them to play.
I knew I could count on Ryan remembering that guy's name. He didn't have to look up on his phone or anything. So that's really good, Ryan. So
when
yeah,
when it comes to any sport guy, for some reason, my memory just works like a charm, yeah, but not for actual useful things in life.
I think one of the funnest shows I ever did with Bob is when we did a show after that game on Tim Tebow and those amazing stats in that game, like the 316 passing yards. And we just did a show on Tebow in general. And that was, man, I had a field day with that one. You know, I was kind
of, well, yeah. I bet that was a lot of fun.
So, Ryan, this article in Creation Magazine International, it did remind me of something from ICR, and that's the Institute of Creation Research. And there's this little debate going on. It's pretty interesting between the major creation groups. And this article here mentions a mutation, but the problem is creationists have fallen into the trap of kind of going along with some of the mutation plus selection being a mechanism that shows change in the world. And so Randy Galuza, he's the president of ICR, and I think he's got some really great arguments. I want to do a show on this in the future, but he thinks that mutation slash selection is a calamitous creationist concession. And I just want to read highlights from an article he wrote in real, I believe this is the most recent Acts and Facts from ICR. It's another very good magazine. It's not as in-depth as Creation Magazine. It's more like a newsletter than a magazine, but it's always very good. And this is from Volume 52, Number 2, Acts and Facts. And it's their March-April edition, 2023. So he's got an article in here, and I just mentioned the title, A Calamitous Creationist Concession, Mutation Selection. I wanted to cover quickly the highlights in this article, and then we'll revisit this topic on a future show. It's an interesting debate. Ryan, when you and I were at the Creation Conference last June, Rob Carter of CMI mentioned this controversy. He takes a side that's, he's more in the selection mutation camp and disagrees with Randy Galuza. But us at RSR, we take the position of Randy Galuza. He's thinking more like an engineer, which, shocker, Real Science Radio, Ryan Williams, software engineer at Micron. I'm in my 40th year as an engineer. Bob Inyart started, he was an engineer during his career. He worked on like helicopter simulations. He wrote for one of the major PC magazines, and he had engagements with Microsoft. He did a lot of cool things in the technical field before he went full-time into ministry. But anyways, here's what Randy Galuza, how he summarizes his article. And again, we'll revisit this topic on a future show. But he said, creation biologists have traditionally accepted some form of mutation selection in their models. This is a fundamental error because accepting mutation selection means accepting an anti-design explanation for life. I think that's a very good point. Mutation selection implies a process without purpose, a random sequence of events. Christ Jesus engineered every living thing with precise purpose. Therefore, genetic selection is specifically directed and designed. ICR's continuous environmental tracking, and that's the project he's working on. It's called CET. I'll repeat it. Continuous environmental tracking. It's a model of adaptation, and it's engineering-based and organism-focused, and it sees genetic sequences as being purposefully designed to solve specific environmental challenges. And he finishes his summary by saying, creation scientists have the opportunity to provide a pro-design explanation for biological change that honors our creator. So we need to talk more about this, that we can't be saying that, oh, you know, fish in a cave that become blind, that's selection and random mutation. We agree with the evolutionists, but it doesn't produce any new information. Well, no, that whole idea is wrong. What Randy Galuza is saying is there's programmed into the genome of these fish in the cave the ability to adapt to their environment, and it happens rapidly, not over many generations of selection and random mutation causing them to eventually go blind. No, we don't agree with that. RSR is fully on board with ICR's position on this, and we look forward to that debate going forward.
I'd recommend looking into that further, and we'll probably have an RSR show on that at some point, probably in the semi-near future.
Yeah, it was an idea that was kind of not like to his degree, but had played in my head for a long time because Dr. Lee Spetner, in his book Not by Chance, he was the first that I can recall of a creationist introducing the idea of non-random mutations. And non-random means design. And evolutionists hate the idea of non-random. They oppose the idea. In fact, they say neo-Darwinism, it's a fundamental tenet that non-random mutations occur, that they don't believe they occur. It's a fundamental tenet to their theory. So there's also...
As if it's non-random, that just blows a hole in the whole thing. It has to be random for them to... for their theory, or else,
yeah,
then that implies the designer, which, you know, they can have none of.
Yeah, they want to rely on nature and random mistakes, which they won't, that won't produce any information. But also, I remember back in the day when I was debating evolutionists really on a constant, regular basis, there was other phenomenon, like an animal would have this gene that they thought was no longer there because of selection, it was gone, and then all of a sudden there'd be scientific. And they'd be reported in the scientific journals of these genes, and somehow they must have been just dormant, because now all of a sudden that trait's back. Well, that fits Randy Galuza's theory that the environment cued that gene to no longer be dormant. So really cool stuff. I'm looking forward to getting into that.
Yeah, the idea of the genome being able to take environmental inputs and then adapt as such to based on those environmental inputs is really, really cool. And it's just another kind of example of God engineering our bodies to just be able to do things that are really, really remarkable.
Well, and just, and I know we want to get to the next story, but it reminds me too, you know, here in Colorado, it's been the coldest winter, wouldn't you say, Dom? I'm looking at our producer. This has got to be the coldest winter that I can remember in a long time. I mean, normally in Colorado, you get these Indian summer days. Well, what's interesting, the body adapts quickly to temperature. So if you're used to this cold weather, and suddenly you get a, say you're used to like 30 degrees, 20, 30 degrees, then suddenly you have a 55 degree day, you go outside and it feels great. You don't need to wear a coat. You could wear shorts. But if you were in the summer and used to 80 or 90 and it all of a sudden became 55 and you had shorts on, it's all of a sudden really cold. And you're like, wow, it's because our body adapts. And I remember Neil, who's, a, I guess you'd call him a cousin-in-law, my wife's cousin's husband. He worked for a oil and gas company, and he was in that Antarctica on a I wouldn't say mission, but an assignment, and he said one day it got up to 0 degrees and they went outside and they're all in their shorts without not wearing a shirt, and it's 0 degrees out because they were used to -20, -30. So again, just that's taking environmental inputs and your body adapts. So really cool stuff.
Where was he at? Was he in Uncle Arctica? Is that what
Yeah. So, you know, I don't know how Bob put up with my bad humor through all the years, but when he asked me to name the continents, I forgot Antarctica. And he goes, there's one you're missing. And I thought about it, and I said, Uncle Arctica. So anyways, somehow he didn't, that survived the editor's, the editing floor. So, so Ryan, what's next?
Yeah. Getting back to it, we're going to go to the cover article from the magazine.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So we had that tease at the beginning of the show on the marmoset and how it apparently is in, they found fossils of this guy in both North Africa and South America. So what's the deal with this, Ryan?
Yeah, so there's fossils from this monkey, the marmoset, which is really just kind of, it applies to a lot of different kinds of monkeys that are pretty similar. And the fossils have been found in both Africa and South America, but now they only live in South America. Like, that's where they're not alive in Africa today.
So you only find marmosets in South Africa, South America.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. And they're just trying to answer the question of, like, how they get there when you, after the flood, what happened for them to be in South America now? Like, was it where they migrated to both places after the flood and then just died in Africa, or was it they were in both places before the flood and then the flood killed them in both places and then they just got back to South America? So the main thing this article is talking about is these things that they call like transatlantic rafting. And, you know, when I first heard about it, I'm like a raft, you're telling me that some monkey was on a leaf and went across the ocean. That's a little, I mean, people weren't doing that until Columbus, you know, how evil he was.
Oh, Columbus used a leaf?
Yeah. Like, they're pretty sophisticated. It took people sophisticated boats to get across, and you're telling me a monkey hops on a leaf and gets over. But it's actually pretty interesting. It's almost as if, like, chunks or little islands are floating across the ocean based on, like some big tsunami or storm happens, breaks off a literal chunk of land, and it takes the monkeys from one place to another. And what the article talks about is how it was something that evolutionists were kind of roasting creationists for, like, oh, what a dumb idea. How could that happen? And now guess what? All of a sudden, they're using this idea to explain some to explain some of the same stuff.
Yeah, so basically it's because they found fossils of this marmoset, which, by the way, is remarkably similar to a modern marmoset. So this isn't, you know, they'll claim that this thing is millions of years old, but hey, why does it look just like a marmoset today? Anyway, so they find these identical fossils on two different continents. And so they have to explain how these things got to South America, because there's this big ocean in between Africa and South America. Well, this gets into another interesting dispute, I'll say, between Creation Ministries International and all the big creation groups and Walt Brown's hydroplate theory. Because for years, creationists have been saying that migration occurred with animals getting on these flotation mats. And those things really do exist. We've seen them. And that probably does happen in some examples. But we know that there were land bridges at one time. There's really solid scientific evidence for that. But what is the best explanation here for finding fossils in these two different continents? So fossils, remember, they're buried by they have to be buried by a flood. Let's just accept that fossilization is a very specialized process. It's not something, you know, that happens over millions of years. Like, you know, all the buffalo that died in Kansas, Ryan, they're not going to be fossils. Those are going to, from dust we came, dust will return. Those things are turning to dust. So when you find a fossil, we know it was a special condition to make that happen, which in this case is a flood. So what are they doing with flood-buried fossils on Africa and flood-based fossils in South America? Well, guess what? Walt Brown says that at the mid-oceanic ridge, everything was one continent, and you had a bunch of seas, and then the continents broke apart, and those creatures were buried on those two different continents as they spread apart. So now in South America and North and Africa, you've got these animals that are now getting buried by the flood. Makes perfect sense. But unfortunately, the major creationist groups like CMI, which we're doing their wonderful magazine right now, they believe in the catastrophic plate tectonics, where the ocean already existed and then water just splashed around during the flood. That's what they believe. That's what they say. So they also have to come up with a way to explain the fossils on the two areas. And we believe the hydroplate theory is a much better explanation. Now, why are there marmosets in South America today after the Ark landed and all the animals came off? Well, again, land bridges and things like that. It's possible that marmosets migrated back into Africa, Ryan, after the flood, and then they just died off. And we're not going to see them because they're not going to fossilize. They're going to turn into dust if they just didn't survive and died off. So again, this is where, you know, Real Science Radio, we support the hydroplate theory. We've done that for years. We believe there's much more evidence, overwhelming evidence. We think catastrophic plate tectonics it's just not true. We think it's almost impossible for that to be true. The odds of it being true are remarkably low. And if we can just get past this catastrophic plate tectonics, frankly, nonsense, there's much better explanations for this stuff. And you don't have to rely on monkeys getting on a raft to go from, you know, Africa to South America. Creationists should not have to rely on that either. Those things were buried on the same continent, and then the continent split apart. And that's why the fossils are on two different continents.
It's another example of, like what we were talking about in Randy Galuza's article, how creationists sometimes kind of kowtow to evolution's theories and then sort of run with them and just kind of try to make them our own. Like, they, you know, took the normal plate tectonics idea and then just kind of tried to fit into creation, as opposed to let's look at what we see, let's look at the evidence and then try to figure out what happened.
Yeah,
as opposed to taking their theory and then trying to make it our own, you know, monkey with it a little bit, no pun intended, and then and then try to fit that theory into our worldview, as opposed to let's just take what we see in science and figure, and then make a theory based on what happened.
Yeah, and man's been doing that all along. Like, with trying, you know, Christians will try to fit evolution into the Bible. Dr. John Baumgartner, who first came up with catastrophic plate tectonics, he admitted that his goal was to get plate tectonics into the Bible. How about start with the Bible first, which was what Walt Brown did. Walt Brown has the best evidence from the Bible to support his theory. And that's where you need to start. And then the evidence can lead you where it may. And right now the evidence has totally led us away from catastrophic plate tectonics. It's totally led us away from theistic evolution and all these other ideas that are secular in origin. And we just need to let go of some of these problems. And again, with what you mentioned with Randy Galuzzo on the whole mutation selection thing, that's a whole nother area where, hey, let's get back to something that actually fits the Bible a lot better and don't kowtow to the secular atheists who are always going to be proven wrong. The wisdom of the world is foolishness to God. And
yeah, I was just thinking how, like, are we really going to go off of what these legitimate fools are saying? They're fools. Their ideas are so bad.
Yeah.
They're just so bad.
And that's biblical language there.
And we're going to go off their ideas. Like, it doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, the guys who invented the idea that we're talking now, but millions of years ago we were dirt or, you know, some stupid little amoeba. Just we're really going off what these people are saying, their ideas. It just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me.
Yeah, exactly. So, and that's why we do this show. And we're hoping that you can continue to sponsor our show, support our show, and send us in your emails. And thanks to that listener who's sent in a few others. And I just loved all of the stuff you send in. And we just love them all. We really appreciate them. We appreciate you listening to the show. And speaking of the hydroplate theory and ICR, we're going to have Kevin Lee on soon on one of our shows. And he went to ICR and presented the hydroplate theory, which was fantastic. I mean, so we think we're making headways in one of the great creation groups at ICR. And we're making really good progress, everybody. So if you can support us, we're not run by a big mega church, like Bob used to say. It's just you listeners out there, and you can help us by going to rsr.org/store. There's so many great materials there that you can buy, or you can, you know, make a monthly donation, one-time donation, sponsor a show, whatever you want to do. We really appreciate it. So, Ryan, was there any last article you wanted to cover before we wrap this up? There were so many good ones. This, again, was Creation Magazine, Volume 45, Number 2. Highly recommend you subscribe to this. Get the paper version and leave it lying around your house. When you're done with it, take it when you go on an airplane and leave it in the airplane folder. Leave it on your doctor's table in the doctor's office, in the dentist office. It's a really wonderful witnessing tool.
Yeah, I used to leave these in the CSU library. There's a lot of
That's cool.
Who knows if people picked them up ever? And this one especially, the Spokus articles are really good. I was just reading through, and they're all really interesting. You know, sometimes when you've read through the Focus articles in every magazine, it's all cool, but it's stuff it's, you know, that you kind of already knew, or it's just another example of some, you know, some piece of evidence for the